Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Senate Republicans are looking to pass their version of an Obamacare repeal bill, even if it means keeping the contents largely secret from their colleagues and the American people.
They're trying desperately to keep their promise to vote for anything that they can call Obamacare repeal. They're determined to keep their promise.
Also today, when do words constitute a deadly crime?
The Commonwealth has proven beyond a reasonable doubt that Ms. Carter's actions and also her failure to act constituted wanton and reckless conduct.
We'll get legal analysis on the precedent set in the case of Michelle Carter. Plus, from Caesar to Donald Trump, how Shakespeare is stirring up contemporary political passion.
Neither Shakespeare nor the public theater could possibly advocate violence as a solution to political problems.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Somewhere on Capitol Hill, behind closed doors, a group of about a dozen senators are meeting in secret to craft a secret bill with unknown provisions and impacts. There are no committee hearings, no draft text for the full Senate to peruse, only a reported PowerPoint presentation whose slides flash across the screen so quickly they can hardly be committed to memory, according to one perplexed senator. Well, the bill and whatever's in it could drastically change the lives of tens of millions of people, and not for the better. But Senate leadership wants a full floor vote on the mystery legislation before the 4th of July. And, you know, I really wish I could say that we're talking about a minor subplot in an early season of House of Cards, but we're not. We're talking about the Senate's health care bill. So joining us now to demystify what's going on in the Senate is Julie Rovner. She's chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, it's great to talk with you.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, so I punched up the melodrama there a little bit, but I'm reading the Senate's own historians say that there hasn't been a secret process like this in the Senate since World War I. Is it really that secretive?
It is pretty secretive. You know, this is not to say that Congress hasn't had closed, you know, negotiations before. In fact, lots of negotiations, particularly on delicate things, are closed. But what we've never seen before is a bill of this magnitude that's being completely written in secret and that's being kept from even other Republicans in the Senate. I mean, they're, you know, people have gone around and asked Republicans what's in their bill, and they just can't answer. And some of them get frustrated and say, I don't know. I would wish I knew.
Well, so how much are senators likely to know? I mean, what are they going to be given before, or on the day that they could perhaps take a vote?
Well, of course, there's a process. They're doing what's called budget reconciliation, and there are very specific rules for how reconciliation gets handled. It can't be filibustered by the minority. That's why Republicans are using it. There's a required 20 hours of debate, after which members can offer unlimited amendments, but they have to stick around and vote for all of those amendments in a row. There is some talk. There's a thought that the bill would be revealed before they start the 20 hours of debate, but there are, you know, some sort of theories going around that perhaps they would start debating the House-passed bill and not even unveil the Senate amendment until the very end of the debate and only give people a few hours. I would guess that the Republicans themselves, the rest of the Republican Party, would object to that sort of process. I fully expect that we will see this before it goes to the floor. We just might not see it very much before it goes to the floor.
Julie, I'm going to ask you in a moment about the little things that we may know about what's in the bill now. But first, I just can't quite let go of the secrecy going on here. I mean, you've been covering healthcare on the Hill for a long time. This just feels utterly bizarre. I mean, what reasoning is Senate leadership giving for holding secret a bill that could change the lives of, I don't know, 25 million people?
Well, they don't actually have to give a reason for making it secret. And as they point out, and I wrote a story last week, I've been doing this for 31 years. This is above and beyond anything that I've ever seen. And I got pushback from both sides. I got pushback from Republicans saying, oh, this is what the Democrats did during part of the Affordable Care Act. And I got, you know, pushback from Democrats saying, you're giving this a false equivalency. You're not going far enough. The fact is that we've often seen secret parts of the legislating process, sometimes at the very beginning, sometimes at the very end, sometimes in the middle, like we did with the Affordable Care Act, where actually the Senate bill, after two committees spent weeks and months hammering out their versions, then Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, you know, went not so much behind closed doors into his own office, and you know, one of his aides sort of famously put the bills together into what would actually become most of the Affordable Care Act. So there have been secret pieces of this before, but we've never really seen this level of we don't want to show you because we kind of know that it's unpopular and we're hoping to just let, you know, we Republicans promised to repeal Obamacare, so we want to just do it really quick and not give the opposition time to build up against it.
But correct me if I'm wrong. For Obamacare, though, I mean, there may have been secret moments in the long, now, you know, sordid history of that bill being passed, but no, there were hours upon hours of open committee hearings. And didn't President Obama even go to a Republican leadership conference to answer any questions they had about the bill?
He did, and there was a rather famous event at Blair House where he had the Republicans in to try to, you know, see what they could offer up if there was some way. Remember, this started out as a bipartisan proposal. This was, you know, basically Congress copying what then-Governor Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts. I mean, this was a Republican idea, and the Republicans just decided that they simply did not want to participate, and that's how it ended up being so partisan.
So there's one more thing I want to ask you about the secrecy here, and I'll probably circle back to it anyway. But I'm seeing that Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, said one of the reasons why they don't want to hold public hearings over the Senate's current health care bill that's being created somewhere in a smoky dark room somewhere is that, quote, we have zero cooperation from the Democrats. So getting it in public gives them a chance to get up and scream. I mean, is that Orrin Hatch just basically saying they don't want to open up their bill to any kind of criticism because that could deep six it even before it gets to the floor for a vote?
Yeah, basically. You know, remember, Orrin Hatch is chairman of the Finance Committee. He's the person who's being sort of most disadvantaged by this process. He should be presiding over the writing of this bill. The budget instructions were that the Finance Committee, and along with, to a lesser extent, the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees, were supposed to come up with this bill, and he's really only sort of tangentially involved in it.
This is so bizarre. Okay, so what do we know, if anything, of what is either in the bill or what might be in it?
Well, we don't exactly know what's in it, but we certainly know what they are arguing about. They are arguing about Medicaid, the Medicaid program for people with low incomes. Two pieces of that. One is the expansion that was in the Affordable Care Act so that people who were not otherwise eligible for Medicaid, meaning they were not women, pregnant women, children, elderly or disabled, were for the first time allowed onto Medicaid simply because they had low incomes. The Republicans want to phase out that expansion. It's the House would phase it out in 2 years. The Republicans in the Senate, some of the more moderates, want to have sort of a slower phase down so people aren't cut off immediately, although eventually they would be cut off. The bigger Medicaid issue is whether or not the federal government for the first time will cap the amount that it provides to states for the Medicaid program. This has been, since its inception in 1965, a shared program. As many people as are eligible, the federal government pays its share, which is at least half and more than half in less wealthy states. So those are two really big issues. And then there are some sort of smaller issues about the extent to which they can change insurance regulations in the bill, whether insurance companies have to continue to not charge people with pre-existing conditions more. There's some question about whether that's even going to be allowed in the Senate bill because of its budget rules. Ditto with defunding Planned Parenthood, which also may or may not be allowed in the Senate bill. So those are some of the things that we know that they're arguing about. What we don't know is where they've come out.
Yeah. So again, like every one of those things that you mentioned, from the big to the little, they all seem major to me, which is once again why I can't quite let go of the fact that all of this is happening in secret. Just quickly, though, again, from what we kind of know about what the Senate's thinking about, is it meaningfully different than what the House passed, their wildly unpopular American Health Care Act?
Well, that's what we don't know yet. Of course, the president rather now famously, you know, said that the House bill was mean, wants the Senate to be more generous. But to the extent that the Senate becomes more generous, there's two problems. One, they'd have to pay for it, which means they can't repeal all of the taxes. And two, this bill will have to go back to the House, and you'll have to get a majority in the House again. And House conservatives just today are warning the Senate, you know, don't get too moderate or we won't be able to pass it over here. So it's a very delicate balance.
Okay, so I want to play a piece of tape here because you mentioned a little earlier that there has been some criticism, some grumbling from Senate Republicans themselves. So here's Republican Senator Marco Rubio. He was on CBS's Face the Nation.
The Senate is not a place where you can just cook up something behind closed doors and rush it for a vote on the floor. There's just, especially on an issue like this. So they may, the first step in this may be crafted among a small group of people, but then everyone's going to get to weigh in, and it's going to take a long, you know, it's going to take days and weeks to work through that in the Senate.
Julie Rovner, what I didn't hear Marco Rubio say is out and out, he doesn't like the secret process, and he's going to demand Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to put more things out in the sunlight, because couldn't he do that? I mean, the Republicans can only afford to lose a couple of votes in the Senate that would then kill the bill, right?
Exactly. Several people are pointing out, you know, a little bit of hypocrisy here from some of these Senate Republicans who are saying, we don't like this process at all. If three of them said that they won't vote for the bill unless the process is opened up, the process would have to be opened up because they can only afford to lose two votes and still pass it.
And no one has said that so far.
Not that we know of, but certainly the process, you know, that I think they agree that, you know, going out and having public hearings and a formal markup process would just drag it out much too long. They want to get to tax reform. They want to do other things. They don't want to prolong this. But so it's easy for them to say, we wish this process wasn't in secret. But, you know, the one thing that Senator Rubio said that's not quite the case is that it won't drag out over days and weeks on the Senate floor because they are using this fast track procedure, that it only has 20 hours of debate and then however many amendments they can stay awake to offer.
I have to say, I mean, it's obvious to listeners that I feel personally alarmed about what this means for the Democratic process of in terms of bill making on Capitol Hill. But Julie, from the perspective of all the challenges that the American healthcare system faces, I mean, what concerns do you have about the fact that this is the means by which the august body of the United States Senate is trying to come up with new legislation to reform healthcare in this country?
You know, every time one House of Congress changes parties, they always say they're going to go back to what's called regular order, meaning they go through the formal public process. And neither of them ever does. And in fact, in most cases, they just go further away from it. And this is another example of going further away from, you know, letting people participate in the process by which legislation that in this case affects almost a fifth of the economy is being made. You know, whatever side you're on, it should be of some concern that this is not really how representative government is supposed to work.
Julie Rovner, she is chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News and an absolute well of experience and analysis on this issue. Thank you so much, Julie, for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
By the way, listeners, send us a tweet at Radio Boston and let us know what you think about the current process that the Senate, the secret process that's going on about health care. Want to know what you think. Again, that's a tweet at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And at the table with me now, I've got a dream team of three of the smartest women I know. Carrie Goldberg, she does health for WBUR. Judge Nancy Gertner obviously talks to us about law. And Asma Khalid talks to us about tech and business. And we're going to hear from all of them about different things for this segment here. And let's start with the law. Can we, Judge Gertner?
Yes, we can.
Okay, because here's the thing. When words are considered a weapon, where do we draw the criminal line? And that was the question we were left wondering after the verdict of the Michelle Carter trial. And just to remind folks, 20-year-old Carter was convicted by a judge of involuntary manslaughter for encouraging her friend to commit suicide via a series of texts. Now, in his decision, Judge Lawrence Moniz cited the fact that Carter texted Conrad Roy to, quote, get back in his truck, filling it with carbon monoxide after he had left it.
She did not issue a simple additional instruction. Get out of the truck.
Well, as I said earlier, Nancy Gertner is WBUR's legal analyst and a former or retired U.S. federal judge. It's good to have you back, Judge Gertner.
Good to be here.
Okay, so what kind of precedent did Judge Moniz's guilty finding of Michelle Carter set?
Well, he clearly extended involuntary manslaughter, that law, to an area that it had never been in before. Typically, we don't have, for example, an assisted suicide statute here, which would criminalize the act of assisting a suicide. So he shoehorned involuntary manslaughter into this. And you typically didn't find cases like this where the person wasn't present, where the first person didn't provide the instrumentalities of the crime, someone sort of providing you with the drugs that you need to kill yourself. So that is an extension. What he focused on is the moments when Roy was in the truck and essentially a failure to intervene. And that's an extension as well. We don't have Good Samaritan laws in Massachusetts. That is to say, you could be walking down the street, you see the bank across the way being robbed, and you actually have no obligation to intervene. So he said she created the threat by her words. She created the danger by her words. That's an extension. There's no question about it.
Okay, so let's listen to a little bit more tape here from the courtroom. Again, this is Judge Lawrence Moniz. And maybe this is what you're referring to. He was citing a different case that helped inform his ruling, Commonwealth versus Levesque.
In Commonwealth versus Levesque, it is indicated that where one's action create a life-threatening risk to another, there is a duty to take reasonable steps to alleviate the risk.
So is this yet another factor that the judge used in his ruling?
Yes, although Commonwealth versus Levesque was a famous case. It was a bunch of two homeless people who were in a building, and I believe it was Worcester. They accidentally started a fire and then did not tell anyone that it was going on. So here, the question is the causation question. She didn't intervene when she knew he was committing suicide. But there's at least an open question as to whether she created the risk that he would kill himself.
You know, I'm remembering opening statements in this case where Michelle Carter's defense team essentially said there's no statute that criminalizes the words and language that she used. And that their concern was that the prosecution was trying to go around that fact. I mean, has this ruling essentially done that? Is there now a legal precedent that all future prosecutors are going to point to and say those texts in the Carter case were equivalent to, I don't know, there was a young man, this is a terrible metaphor, but a young man standing at the edge of a cliff, and the texts are what pushed him over the cliff.
Well, it is an extension. There's no question about it. I mean, the notion we don't criminalize words is not completely true. If I threaten you with assault, then I have now, the threat is a crime. But it's not, this is threatening you. This is basically not just the words, but the result. It's one thing to take the act of what she did and saying it is something wrong with it. You're holding her responsible for the result, and that's new.
Okay, I want to just cut to the chase here. Do you think this was a good or a bad ruling?
I think it's a stretch. I don't think the criminal law should be used to extend liability to places that it hasn't been before. I mean, there's no question that this behavior was horrendous. But the criminal law doesn't map one-to-one on horrible conduct.
I mean, because free speech advocates think this is an atrocious ruling.
Well, the question is going to be whether someone's on Facebook, for example, and talks about, gee, I think you should commit suicide, that the context is going to be everything. And this opens the door, and there's no question.
But this is exactly what I was wondering about all day, or actually even from last week when the ruling came down, because it's terrible, but the truth is that these kind of horrible threats, nasty words, just incitements are rampant on social media. I mean, this might be extreme, but like in the future, if some poor person ends up taking their own life, might we have a case where 10,000 trolls are put on trial for. I mean, I'm not joking. That's why we're wrestling with whether or not this is a meaningful precedent.
Well, that's right. But it's not only what she said; it's also with the extent to which she is responsible for that result. Those are two separate things. I mean, you could call this harassment, you could call this threats, you could call this anything you want. But to hold her responsible for the result is what's key here. And yes, it's true that what the judge was struggling with is what all judges are struggling with now, which is we're used to a physical environment and we're applying statutes. statutes that came from the physical environment to essentially a technological environment, a digital environment, and how does that map on? So he was talking about her virtual presence, but it is an extension. And in other states, this kind of area is regulated not by a judge extending a, you know, common law statute, but by legislation with assisted suicide, et cetera.
Well, do you think we're going to get...
Jumping in here. Yes, yeah. Yes. So that's what I've most been wondering about is what will this mean for medical aid in dying, or previously called assisted suicide? If someone's, certainly there will be doctors facing this and loving relatives whose relatives are asking for help. Does that mean you absolutely must say, no, you must not die? What does it mean?
Well, that's right. I mean, this certainly opens the door because, as I said, this was a common law statute that was shoehorned into a situation that didn't otherwise address it. So right now, the sky's the limit. Now, the problem here is that the Supreme Judicial Court allowed this indictment to go forward. And so the issue is whether they will look more critically at the result, because they'll get the appeal again, and that's an open question.
Okay. Well, I mean, just to be clear, I mean, I've been seeing some other legal analysts, Daniel Medved, for example, a law professor at Northeastern, saying that Massachusetts legislators could possibly pass a law criminalizing suicide. As you mentioned earlier, we don't have a law like that.
We don't have a law that criminalizes suicide nor assisted suicide. And that would deal with this kind of situation. So instead you take a common law concept, which typically never applied to anything like this.
So to get back to another major point you're making here, Judge Gertner, so here is the law trying to catch up with where we are in terms of technology and how technology has an impact on how we live. But I'm not quite sure. Are you saying that the court is not a good place for us to catch up there, that it should happen through policy and legislation?
No, I mean, I'm saying the criminal law is uniquely ill-suited as a matter of constitutional law to apply to new situations. In other words, the idea is that the criminal law is supposed to be clear, that you know the kinds of risks you're taking. There was language in this case that she knew that you know, she might be doing something illegal, but did she understand that she would be held accountable for his death? And if we want to do that, we don't do that with a case that after the fact criminalizes something that had never been criminalized before.
Okay. So that's Judge Nancy Gertner. And stay with us. I'm not going to let you out of the studio. So let's put aside this conversation about Michelle Carter and that case and move on to another interesting story about technology and how it's changing our lives. And Asma Khalid, head of Bostonomics, our WBR business and tech team, is going to talk to us about that. Hello, Asma.
Hey, Meghna.
All right. So you've been doing reporting on JetBlue, and folks who may be traveling from Boston to Aruba this summer may not have to have a boarding pass because JetBlue is testing facial recognition software that's going to allow passengers at Logan to use a biometric scan of their faces instead of showing their boarding passes at the gate. So really, really interesting, Asma. Explain, what exactly is the airline doing?
So, Meghna, I actually was at Logan Airport last week to see how this all works in action. And I will say that right now they're really keen on saying that this is a pilot. They're experimenting for somewhere between 45 to 90 days, and they want to get a sense of how sort of conducive this is to streamlining the boarding process. I really wanted to get a better understanding, though, of what exactly JetBlue is doing. And so I spoke with Joanna Garrity. She's the VP of Customer Experience at JetBlue.
What we are rolling out on a trial basis is the first ever effort between an airline and Customs and Border Protection to use biometrics and facial recognition technology in the boarding process. The practical side of that is you will not need to show a boarding pass, and you will not need to take your passport out when you board a flight at the gate, because your face will be essentially your boarding pass and your passport to enter that flight and board.
So, Meghna, I saw this, and the way that it works is there were actually two lanes. One, if you wanted to opt for the manual traditional boarding process. The other, if you wanted to go up to this facial scanner. And it's essentially just a camera, say the size of a shoebox, uh-huh, that's on a little sort of contraption up there. And the passengers step up. It's kind of akin to taking a selfie. You see your picture there.
Yeah.
That picture is then compared with the flight manifest. And they have pulled sort of your picture from this database of photos that they already have of you that Customs and Border Protection,
it's interfacing with a federal database. Okay.
Exactly. And if you pass, you can go right through. You know, JetBlue talks about this as if it'll be a much faster boarding process. I kind of got a sense that it took about 25 minutes. I didn't feel like it was exceptionally faster, but I will say that's in part because the day I went, there were loads of media outlets. And so I think that's caused some issues with trying to figure out which face the scanner needs to focus on.
Okay, and then did the technology actually work, or were there any glitches when you saw it?
So it worked for the most part. When there were a number of these video cameras behind it, there was some glare that hit the machine. It broke down. They had to restart it, and then it was up and running again.
Oh, okay. So if the lights from the video cameras.
That's my understanding of what the tech folks explained.
Okay. Now, what about passengers? Because this was in active use at Logan. I mean, did you talk to people who liked the idea, or maybe not so much?
So, Meghna, I talked to a whole host of people just waiting in the area. This was outside of Gate 14, Terminal C. This is the only place in Logan where this is actually being experimented with. And nobody really seemed particularly phased. The system for now is voluntary, and JetBlue is keen to explain to passengers that if you feel uncomfortable, you don't have to go through it. But I would say that overwhelmingly, people opted for the facial recognition scan, which somewhat
surprised me. All these early adopters.
Okay. So I spoke to a number of passengers. One is Michelle Moynihan. She was one of the many people who went through this. She's 34 years old from Cape Cod.
Typically when I travel, I have my three kids with me. When I travel alone with them, they're all under age 10. So flipping through multiple boarding passes on my phone, making sure I have all the kids, all the backpacks, all the suitcases can be cumbersome and frustrating. So just the facial recognition would make things a lot smoother, quicker, easier.
And Meghna, she wasn't isolated. I heard the same thing from essentially almost everyone I talked to, this idea of it's safer, it's quicker. Here's another young woman. Her name is Jamie. She's from Rhode Island.
I think it's the way of the future, and I think that if that's going to help us keep, you know, safety and also the lines moving faster and, you know, to be a little bit more modern, I think I will use it.
And Meghna, I admit, I was surprised. I did not anticipate there being such widespread, easy adoption, but, I mean, it's a sample size. Take it for what it is.
I mean, look, maybe it's because I spend so much time in a newsroom and it's full of skeptical human beings. I am shocked, too.
No, I was. Yeah.
I mean, the national security part, I get. Can we do a poll of two here?
I mean, I would love it because you can't lose your boarding pass.
So this is what the young mom said, right? Like, she doesn't have to be leafing through her purse for all her children's boarding passes.
But, you know, for me, it's like, okay, putting your privacy at risk for the sake of convenience of flipping through your... Carrie, you don't seem to care.
Well, it's an airport. You don't have a lot of privacy. They have you on file. They're looking at your foot.
Well, but I wonder if it's a generational thing, which is that if you have a generation that it already has no concept of privacy, this is really minor.
I would have thought that, but I asked the ages of everyone I interviewed. And I interviewed people into their 50s and 60s who were totally on board with this, in part because they felt like it would be better for national security, which was an interesting take as well, you know, on what this technology could offer.
Okay, now, I didn't realize until you started reporting this story that biometric scans or biometric technologies had come far enough for this to happen, for these facial recognition things to happen very relatively quickly for, you know, something as potentially chaotic as the boarding process.
Well, you think about your reporting last week on Tsarnaev, right? Yes. Two different pictures involving the same person.
But so how good is the technology now?
So I asked this question, you know, to a couple of different people who are working in facial recognition technology. And what I will say is that this idea was actually introduced after 9/11, and it didn't work particularly well at that point in time. So I wanted to get a sense of actually what does this basic technology look like? Does it work? Like, take what JetBlue and Customs and Border Protection are actually doing out of the equation, right? Because they're dealing with a specific algorithm. So I asked this to Mario Savides. He's a facial recognition expert at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, and he said the tech is just really exponentially better than 2001.
We can do things almost, you know, two orders of magnitude faster, maybe even three compared to back then. So definitely a combination of algorithms and computation power, which has essentially been driven down in cost.
And Meghna, so this is the thing that's interesting, is he says he doesn't know the specific algorithms that Customs is using, but he told me that some of the work they're doing at Carnegie Mellon, that they can actually detect people essentially based on their eye region, that the eyebrows are very indicative of what a person looks like, and they've been able to run tests where people are wearing face masks, but they can still correctly identify them.
Just by the eye region.
But the eyebrow region is very apparently key in terms of what we look like.
Okay, so apparently no one at this table, perhaps with me being the exception, is concerned about privacy. But But you talked to some civil libertarians who have a concern.
I did. And part of it, Meghna, I will say, is that I think some of the passengers don't really understand entirely what's, like, two things are getting a little jumbled up together. One is the efficiency of boarding, and the other is a biometric exit system that's enforced by Customs and Border Protection. And there's a little sign when you get up to the counter that explains this is part of customs. But I don't think a lot of people actually put those two things together. And so when I talk to, you know, folks like the ACLU, what they're concerned about is that people are not correctly actually understanding how some of their photos will be stored and scanned. Mm-hmm. And I specifically heard this from Cade Crockford. She's with the ACLU here in Massachusetts. She runs their Technology for Liberty program.
Facial recognition technology is dangerous for a number of reasons. One of them is because you cannot change your face very easily, right? You can change your name, even. People do it all the time when they get married. You can change your social security number if it's stolen. It is not easy to change your fingerprint or your face.
And so, Meghna, what I think bothered her, sort of, you know, not the idea that we should all go around and want to sort of change our identification, but the idea that your face is a really intimate part of who you are. And so it's the ability that we're sort of all losing. We're losing this sense of intimacy. And so she described it as such that, you know, what people don't understand is when you stand up and you allow your photo to be, your, you know, your face to be scanned, you are thereby allowing Customs and Border Protection to get better at recognizing you. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is essentially what you're helping them do.
Right.
You'll match their face.
Also, can we count on this only staying with Customs and Border Protection?
Right. So I spoke to the folks at Customs actually just earlier today and asked them sort of logistically, what is this all about? Because, you know, JetBlue is a tiny part of this big equation. I'm sure you all remember there is actually a congressional mandate for biometric exits. And so they have been slowly trying to roll this out from a customs level at like Dulles Airport, I think Atlanta's airport. And this will be somewhat widespread, they said, by the end of the summer, at least the pilot schemes. And so I asked them about the sort of storage of photos. And they insisted that, look, we've already got pictures of you if you have a visa or a passport. And what we're doing is we're matching them. But we don't store U.S. citizens. What we store are non-U.S. citizens, according to sort of congressional legislative mandates that they have to in order for biometric exits.
Okay, for now, at least as far as so much as we know.
For now, yeah. And I mean, but Meghna, there are, I mean, I recognize those concerns. And they'll be very candid and say that it'll help them hopefully track down people more effectively who have overstayed their visas.
Good point. And so getting back to your point earlier that a lot of people you spoke to actually preferred the system because it could enhance national security.
A couple of people did. I think most folks, if I had to sort of generalize, talked a lot about what Carrie was saying. It's the ease. It's the efficiency. It's the I've got three kids and where are the boarding passes?
And they've got you anyway.
On your phone. I mean, come on. Okay. So that is the story of JetBlue's facial recognition pilot program going on at Boston Logan Airport. So we've done law. We've done tech. Let's do the brain, Carrie.
Okay, let's.
Can we do that?
Because, always.
Because in Common Health, you've been reporting this story about food zombies.
So
what is that?
Yeah, I have to admit, I kind of made that up. But my thinking is that a food zombie is what I turn into sometimes, and maybe you do too. It's this feeling that, you know, usually it's the evening. You don't really want to eat, but you're a bit peckish. And then something turns you into a food zombie. Often it's a powerful TV image of like steaming, gleaming meat and pasta at certain restaurants.
It's like the story of my life.
Yes,
I'm fasting right now, Carrie.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I am totally.
Anyway, and so off you go, staggering with your arms outstretched, like to the fridge or the cupboard. You rummage around. Actually, it's probably you this evening to find something to sate the craving. Right?
Okay, so you're about to tell us about how Asma's brain is actually changing in response to her fasting. But so, Judge Gertner, has this ever happened to you?
Are you kidding? Of course. But I like the notion of sort of, you know, mindlessly walking to the refrigerator looking for anything.
Right. So if you felt this, you felt how deep an urge this can be. And so you won't be surprised to learn that it emanates from what's called the bottom of the brain, the sort of very ancient primitive part. And I learned that from Dr. Mark Anderman of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's the co-senior author of a new study in the journal Nature that helps to pin pinpoint what happens in our brains when these images of food turn us into food zombies.
But this is like a Nature paper, so they didn't say food zombies.
They didn't talk about food zombies. They talked about like homeostatic circuits that gate food cue responses. And so those images on TV or that you start thinking about, those are called food cues if you're a scientist who studies this. So the Beth Israel Deaconess researchers looked at mice, not humans. But what's really fascinating is that they found that in mice, by manipulating just a few thousand neurons, they can make a mouse that's just eaten like the equivalent of a Thanksgiving dinner start noticing food cues and eating again.
Again?
Yes.
Okay, I mean, I definitely have never needed an additional food cue after a Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, the coolest part is that they also did the opposite. Like in hungry mice, they could tweak certain neurons and they could block the response to food. So bottom line, here is Dr. Mark Anderman.
This shows specific pathways that control how much someone is going to react to food. And so the idea that it's willpower and you can shut it off at will, I think this pathway shows that it's much more complicated than that.
Hear, hear, right? Now, researchers already knew from previous studies that there are parts of the cortex, the part of your brain kind of on the outside, the rind or the bark, that there are parts of your cortex where hunger is driving you to find food. But no one had understood sort of the pathway from hunger to craving.
Okay, so I mean, to just put it bluntly, so how hunger hijacks your brain meeting the specific purpose. Okay.
Yeah, and that's what Anderman and this Beth Israel Deaconess research team have pinpointed. It's that brain circuit. And using cool new neuroscience tools like chemogenetics, which can be used to turn off and on specific neurons in the brain, they could take a mouse that was totally full and make its brain act like a hungry brain and get the mouse to eat another 10 to 15% of its body weight in food. So that's like 10, 20 pounds for you or me, right? And the key is in a part of the brain called the insular cortex. And as I said, they did the opposite, too. They also showed they could block that response to food in hungry mice.
You know, this is the point of every conversation we have, Carrie, where I'm like, mouse models? How much can that be applied to human brains?
So it's always a long way from mice to people. But the question is, can we stop our brains from forcing us to pay more attention than we want to food? And Mark Anderman says the exciting thing is that this research is looking at brain areas that we already know have been implicated in humans with obesity and in dieters. And so the challenge has been to figure out which ones among millions of human neurons are potential targets for drugs against cravings. And that's what they're starting to be able to do, to try to develop a drug to block cravings, which is my dream. Of course, it's many years away.
Okay, so what do you guys think?
I know is I'm very hungry.
I mean, it is kind of like amazing, Carrie, because okay, like it's Ramadan, right? And I've been fasting, and some days I'm like exorbitantly hungry. I don't even know if that's the right word. I'm just so insanely hungry. And then I could imagine like if it was feasible to take like a pill in the morning, it would be so nice. I mean, I know that's probably not the intended actual, you know, target audience, and it's probably
it
much more along
someday.
The lines of like obesity, but I just feel like there are actual like, as a total like person who is extraordinarily hungry right now, I could see immediate benefits to this.
But it sort of undermines marketing. I was always convinced that McDonald's sort of pumped the smells out of the, you know, out of the
well,
restaurant.
They do.
So you walk by and you know, you are immediately salivating actually until you go and eat, and then you have an entirely different experience.
To me, this is yet another one of the stories that makes me question how much will concept of will actually exists, right?
Yes. So and there's a very practical takeaway.
I guess the concept or the reality of will.
Yeah, and it's limited, right? But the takeaway is that the responses in mice and humans are very different if they're hungry or not hungry to these food images.
Oh, interesting.
And so you want to keep yourself, when you can, keep yourself full of, you know, healthy, filling food so that you don't fall for the cravings.
Right, if they can manipulate your brain so you'd like kale.
I know. Yeah.
Whoa, won't that be wonderful?
As things are becoming more targeted.
There you go. That precision.
The kale neuron. They have to find it.
Wow. Okay. Well, Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
Joining us on this trip through law and technology and neuroscience. And Asma Khalid, head of Bostonomics, WBUR's business and tech team. Great to have you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Nancy Gertner, WBUR's legal analyst and retired U.S. federal judge. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A power trio, if I've ever had one in the studio. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, there's a moment in the New York Public Theater's production of Julius Caesar when a Trump-like Caesar with blonde hair and a long red necktie and a Slavic wife, a person who tweets from a golden bathtub, is violently stabbed to death. So controversy soon followed after the New York Public Theater's production went public. Sponsors Delta Airlines and Bank of America pulled their financial support, saying that the staging crossed the line on standards of good taste. And on Friday, a protester interrupted the performance, running up on stage right after the theatrical assassination.
Liberty. Freedom.
Stop the normalization of political violence against the right. This is unacceptable. You cannot.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to pause. We're going to pause. Security.
Well, the protester, who identified herself on social media, went on to say, quote, this is violence against Donald Trump, and, quote, you guys are just as bad as ISIS. Well, let's get some perspective on this from Tina Packer. She is the founding artistic director of the Shakespeare and Company of Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts. Joins us today from New England Public Radio in Springfield. Tina Packer, a delight to have you back on the show.
Thank you. And it's wonderful to be here. And I think Shakespeare would love it.
He would
love it.
And why would he?
Well, I think it makes him so relevant. You know, he is relevant. And the fact that we find new ways to make him relevant, I'm not saying that what they're doing at the public is actually what happens in Julius Caesar exactly, but the event itself is, and that it has stirred up this controversy, and I'm now talking to you about it. It just is terrific because it is forcing us to ask the questions we need to ask.
Well, so take me back, though. What were the questions that Shakespeare was asking about politics in his time when the play was first staged?
Well, it was revolutionary because, if you remember, there's a queen on the throne, mm-hmm. and we've got the divine right of kings. In other words, you can't budge a queen or a king, for that matter, although the fact that it is a queen is quite revolutionary as well. So we've shifted the meter a little bit, but now we're actually saying it is possible for the leader to be assassinated. And Elizabeth did actually say about Richard II, who was assassinated in another of Shakespeare's plays, I am Richard II. No, you not, I am Richard II. And that she felt that her life was always about assassinations. But what Shakespeare really asks us to think about is how can we remove somebody who is clearly doing something illegal, and is the best way to kill them?
Right.
And the answer that he comes out with is no, it's not. Because in fact, the conspirators who loved Caesar, I have to say, at least Brutus did, he loved Caesar. So he killed the man who was his mentor and his best friend. And because he was frightened he was going to take such absolute power, they could never get it back. And he created civil war, and then they then made the leader the absolute leader. So he actually created the situation he was trying to avoid.
Well, so exactly. So that's the point. It's a political warning as well.
Absolutely.
So I want to play a little bit of tape. This is Oscar Eustace. He's the director of the Public Theater's production of Julius Caesar, the one that's stirring up all of these political passions right now. And he addressed the controversy when speaking to the audience just before the show last Monday.
Neither Shakespeare nor the public theater could possibly advocate violence as a solution to political problems, and certainly not assassination. This play, on the contrary, warns about what happens when you try to preserve democracy by non-democratic means. And again, spoiler alert, it doesn't end up too good.
That's Oscar Eustace. Tina Packer, that's the point you're making. Shakespeare was trying to say that, you know, politics by the tip of a sword or a dagger or whatever Brutus used is possibly not the best idea.
It's not, but if I could say so, the Shakespeare play itself, which has been the center of so much artistic endeavor for so many years, has actually had an effect, because now we do have rules whereby you can get rid of bad leaders. We do have a constitution, and the constitution comes out of our thinking about these things, and our founders said we have to have a way for people to get rid of bad leaders, and so we can get rid of bad leaders now. So if I might say so, I think the Shakespeare play has worked.
You know, it's so interesting because this is also, it's not an unknown or lesser known of Shakespeare's plays, right? We all maybe on occasion have
did you in school.
You, yes. And used a line just in casual conversation, right? Our executive producer, Tetati, today was quoting off some of them about letting slip the dogs of war. And
that's right. And cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and once you do let slip the dogs of war, like we found in Iraq, you know, we didn't do it constitutionally in Iraq. We just went in there and look at the chaos we created. Look at the unutterable chaos we created. And so once you do let slip the dogs of war, you have no control, because people are acting out of emotions, and then other people are being slaughtered and killed, and that sets off trigger emotions, and everybody says this has to stop, but nobody knows how to stop it then.
Tina Packer, let me ask you though, we are in the midst of an American political moment where rhetoric and language and extremes of expression, some people are saying, are quite dangerous. I mean, there was last week's shooting of Republican congressional leaders, and right after that, many people said we have to cool off the political rhetoric. Donald Trump Jr. tweeted, "I wonder how much of this," referring to the play, "this art is funded by taxpayers. Serious question, when does art become political speech, and does that change things?" I mean, do you countenance any of that in terms of the staging of this play?
Well, I do think they had to push it a bit to stage this play, because Julius Caesar in Shakespeare's play is a very powerful leader who's doing things he shouldn't do, but it's his best friends who are going to kill him. At least Brutus is his best friend, because they don't know how to fix it. I'm really glad it stirs up the controversy. I'm not glad when it goes over into violence, but I think that language, by and large, helps violence to dissipate if we can debate, if we can discuss. Martin Luther King, the greatest speaker, and he absolutely eschewed violence. You know, he was explaining, using his anger and his ethical argument to empower through words what it was that he felt. And that, if you don't know how to empower your ethical argument through passion, it doesn't go very far. A dry argument doesn't go very far. And the Elizabethans felt the same. I mean, they were always trying to think, how do we induce a higher consciousness, which they were trying to do through music and verse, you know, in the academies. How do we induce people to be able to think more overview and have a poetic soul, which leads to empathy?
Tina, can I ask you, I mean, there's been, I've been seeing stories here and there amongst other companies that perform Shakespeare a lot, that there's been some spillover from the controversy in New York. Yes. I mean, has there been spillover to Shakespeare and Company in Lenox?
There has quite a lot.
Such as?
Can
you tell me what's happened?
Yes, people have been emailing, sending us emails and texts and leaving messages. Really not nice. But we have been answering them all. And if they call us and leave us a number, we call them back and we ask, you know, we engage them in discussion and debate, and we try and represent the idea that art leads to higher order thinking. And I know that's a fancy way of putting it, but a more empathetic and spiritual way of looking at the world.
Tina, can I just interrupt here for a second?
Yes.
I want to be as transparent as I can in asking you this question, because I think, you know, we're talking about the potency of art and political language. The Washington Post reported, if I remember correctly, that death threats had been sent to Shakespeare and Company. Is that true?
Yes. Yes. But yes. Shall I say any more about it? I mean, it's you know, I mean, we deal in life and death all the time on the stage. And it's not that it isn't alarming to get death threats. It is. But it's much more alarming to live in a country where death is around the corner at any time. And that's not true in Berkshire County. And it certainly is what we are trying to do is actually engage in this discussion, not just say the end. I feel it's people who are so frustrated and so don't know where to place their anger that go to these places. And if it's possible for us to engage in a discussion, we would like to do that. Mm. You know, we're thinking if there's anything further we should do about it. But I think the joy, if I can say, no, the release comes in writing the email or leaving the phone message, not in the act itself. Mm-hmm. I think the people who do the act usually have not had that outlet beforehand, and I might be seriously wrong about that.
Well, let's hope that there's equal amount of, again, joy is not the right word, but engagement. Yes. And understanding through paying close attention to what Shakespeare was actually writing and saying through these modern productions.
Deeply so. And you know, I'm doing Cymbeline right now, which is the most joyous play in which there are hideous acts of violence, but it comes out really well and lots of joy in the end.
Tina Packer, founding artistic director of Shakespeare and Company, thank you as always.
Oh, thank you. I love being on your program.
This is Radio Boston.